You gentlemen want anything to eat between now and dinner, I suggest you wash up quickly. Otherwise there won't be a scone left, or a sandwich either.
Willie rushed through the door Mrs. Chubb had just emerged from.
Mama, I must have a scone, he said. Do wait, I'm coming.
The Texans, under the urging of Mrs. Chubb, hastily splashed themselves with the hot water and rubbed themselves with the towels. Though they had shaved and washed just that morning, the towels were brown with dust when they finished their rubbing. Gus took a swipe or two at his hair with the silver brush, but the rest of the Texans felt awkward even picking up such unfamiliar instruments and left themselves uncombed. Mrs. Chubb, unfazed, shooed them toward the door much as a hen might shoo her chickens. When the Texans entered Lady Carey's room, they were shocked to see Matilda Roberts, pink-faced with wet hair in a clean white smock, sitting on a stool eating biscuits. Beside her in a chair was the lady in black, the one who had sung so movingly over their fallen friends. Gus had hoped to get a glimpse of her face, but he was disappointed. Lady Carey was triply veiled, and the veils were black. Nothing showed at all, not her hair, not her face, not her feet, which were in sharp-toed black boots. Call supposed the woman's face must be badly eaten up, else why would she cover herself so completely? He could get no hint even of the color of her eyes. Yet she was eating when they came in, eating a small thing that seemed to be mostly bread. When Lady Carey wanted to eat, she tilted her head forward slightly and slipped a little bite of bread under the three veils. Just for a second, he saw a flash of white teeth and a bit of chin, which seemed unblemished. "Excuse me, gentlemen," Lady Carey said in a low, friendly voice. "When I'm hungry, I have no manners, and I always seem to be hungry in San Lazaro. I expect it's the wind. When I'm eating, I don't mind it quite so much."
"It blows, don't it?"
Long Bill said. He was surprised that he had been able to utter a word to such a great lady. They were in a large room whose walls had been hung with patterned cloth. The two windows were tightly shuttered. In one corner was a large four-poster bed with a little dog sitting on it. Beside it was a smaller bed where Willie slept.
"Certainly does. It blows," Lady Carey said. "Eat, gentlemen. Don't be shy. I expect it's been a while since you've sat down to a tea such as this." Lady Carey's hands, too, were gloved in black. She reached down with two gloved fingers, took another small piece of the bread, and popped it under the veils and into her mouth. Gus felt that it was his turn to speak. He had been about to address Lady Carey when Long Bill rudely jumped in ahead of him, and only to make a pointless comment about the wind. Before them on the table was an array of food. All of it was rather small food, it seemed to him. They were little pieces of bread cut quite square, with what seemed like slices of cucumber stuck between the squares of bread. Then there were biscuits and muffins, and larger, harder muffins with raisins stuck in them. He thought those might be the things called scones that Willie had referred to. Besides the various muffins and biscuits, there were little ears of corn with a saucer of butter and salt to dip them in. There were tomatoes and apricots and figs, and a plate of tiny fish that proved very salty to the taste. Gus had every intention of saying something complimentary about the food, but something about Lady Carey intimidated him, preventing him from getting even a word out of his mouth. He looked at her and opened his mouth, but then instead of speaking, put a bit of biscuit in his mouth and ate it. The Texans were shy in the beginning. Most of the foods they were being offered were foods they had never tasted. They stuck at first to what was safest, which were the biscuits, but in part because they stuck to them so strictly, the biscuits were soon gone. Then the muffins went, then the scones, then the corn, and finally the various fruits. All the Texans, though, avoided the cucumber sandwiches, even preferring the salty fish. All the while, Mrs. Chubb supplied them with large cups of hot sweet tea. The tea was sweet because Mrs. Chubb dropped square lumps of sugar into it with a pair of silver tongs.
"Lord, that's sweet," Gus said.
None of the Texans had ever tasted pure sugar before. They were amazed by the sweetness it imparted to the tea.
"Oh, well, that's the nature of sugar," Lady Carey said. She too was having tea, but instead of drinking it from a cup, she was sipping it through a hollow reed of some kind, which she delicately inserted under her veils. "This was refined by my chemist, the learned Dr. Gilly," Lady Carey said. "It comes from sugar cane grown on my plantation in the islands. I do think it's very good sugar.
That's where Mama caught leprosy, Willie said, on our plantation. I didn't catch it, and neither did Emerald, and neither did Mrs. Chubb.
Poor luck, I was the only one afflicted, Lady Carrie said.
Well, Papa might have had it, but we don't know because the Mexicans shot him first, Willie said. That's when we were made prisoners of war, when they shot Papa.
Now, Willie, these gentlemen have traveled a long way and lost many friends themselves, Lady Carrie said. We needn't burden them with our misfortunes.
I lost my shad, Matilda said. It was a stray bullet, too. If he'd been sitting anywhere else, I expect he'd still be alive.
Well, Maddie, that's not for sure, Gus said. We walked a far piece after that through all that cold weather.
Cold wouldn't have killed my shad, Matilda said. I would have hugged him and kept him warm.
It is cold in our castle, Willie said. There aren't many fires. But we have cannons, and some day I will shoot them. When will we go back to our castle, Mama? That depends on these gentlemen, Lady Carrie said. We'll discuss it as soon as they finish their tea. It's very impolite to discuss business while one's guests are enjoying their food.
We can talk now, I guess, Carl said. If you've a plan for leaving here, I'm for talking now.
Fine. There's nothing left but the cucumber sandwiches anyway, Lady Carrie said. I suppose cucumbers are not much valued in Texas, but we Scots have a fine appetite for them. Come help me, Willie. And you too, Mrs. Chubb. Let's finish off the sandwiches and plan our expedition.
Carl was enjoying the breads and muffins and fruit. Everything he put in his mouth was tasty, particularly the small buttery ears of corn. After the cold, dry trip they had made across the prairies and the desert, it seemed a miracle that they had come through safe and were eating such food in the company of an English lady, her servants, and her little boy. He was startled, though, when she mentioned an expedition.
The country around El Paso was as harsh as any he had seen. 5 rangers, 4 women, and a boy wouldn't stand much chance, not unless the Mexican army was planning to go with him.
First, we need proper introductions, Lady Carrie said. I'm Lucinda Carey. This is Mrs. Chubb, this is Emerald, and this is Willie. You know our names, but we don't know yours. Could you tell us your names, please?
Gus immediately told the lady that his name was Augustus McCrae. He was determined that Long Bill Coleman not be the first to speak to the fine lady who had fed them such delicious food.
"Why, Willie, he's Scott, like us," Lady Carey said. "I expect we're cousins, 20 times removed, Mr. McCrae."
The news perked Gus up immediately.
The other rangers introduced themselves. Woodrow Call was last. Long Bill took it upon himself to introduce Brognoli, whose head was still swinging back and forth, regular as the ticking of the clock. None of them knew how to behave to a lady. Long Bill attempted a little bow, but Lady Carrie didn't appear to notice.
She divided the cucumber sandwiches between herself and Mrs. Chubb and Willie, who ate them avidly.
All the while, Emerald, the tall negress, stood watching near the bed. The little dog had gone to sleep and was snoring loudly.
"Throw a pillow at him, Willie. Why must we hear those snores?" Lady Carrie said when the last cucumber sandwich was gone.
Willie immediately grabbed 3 pillows off a red settee and threw them at the sleeping dog, which woofed, woke up, shook itself, and ran off to bed into Lady Carrie's arms.
"This is George. He's a smelly beast," Lady Carrie said.
The little dog was frantically attempting to lick her, but the best he could do was lick her black gloves. Carl was watching the tall negress Emerald. She stood by the 4-poster bed, keeping her eye on the company. She wasn't unfriendly, but she wasn't familiar either. She was wrapped in a long blue cloak. Call wondered if she had a gun under the cloak, or at least a knife.
He could see that she was protective of Lady Carrie and the little boy. He would not have wanted to be the one who attacked them, not with Emerald there. While he was sipping the last of his tea, he happened to look up and see the head of a large snake raised over the canopy of the 4-poster bed. In a second, the snake's long body followed. It was far and away the largest snake Carl had ever seen. He looked around the table, hoping to see a knife he could kill it with, but there was no knife except the little one they had used to spread butter. He grabbed one of the little stools and was about to run over and try to smash the big snake with it when the negress calmly stretched out a long black arm and let the snake slide along it. All the rangers gave a start when they saw the snake slide onto Emerald's arm. Soon it was draped over her shoulders, its head stretching out toward the table where the tea had been.
"No cause for alarm, gentlemen," Lady Carrie said. "That's Elphinstone. He's Willie's boa."
"Only he's too big for me," Willie said. "Mama and Emerald play with him now. Mrs. Chubb doesn't care for snakes. She hides her eyes when Elphinstone eats his rats."
Emerald walked over and handed the boa to Lady Carrie, who let it slither over her lap and off under the table.
"I think he wants George," Lady Carrie said. "Cake crumbs don't satisfy a boa, but I expect a smelly little beast such as George would be a treat."
"But, Mama, he can't have George," Willie insisted. "He finds quite a lot of rats. I shouldn't think he'd need to eat our dog."
"Who knows what a boa needs, Willie?" Lady Carrie said. "I'm afraid we've let all these beasts distract us. Willie and I want to go home, gentlemen, and the Mexican government has agreed to release us. What they won't do is provide us with an escort, and we're rather a long way from a seaport."
"I'll say," Long Bill said. "It's so far I wouldn't even know which one to head for."
"Galveston is the most feasible, I believe," Lady Carrie said. "I'd rather try for Galveston than Veracruz. If we travel through Mexico, the greedy generals might decide they want more ransom. My father has already paid them a handsome sum. He didn't pay it for me, of course. Father wouldn't waste a shilling on a leprous daughter. He paid it for the young Viscount here. Willie's the one he needs. Willie's the heir."
The rangers listened silently to what Lady Carrie said. Call looked at Gus, who looked at Long Bill. Brognoli continued to swing his head, and Wesley Buttons, who was a slow eater, was still consuming the last crumbs of one of the big scones with raisins in it. The others had accepted that the big snake was a pet, but Wesley didn't trust snakes, particularly not snakes that were longer than he was tall. This one had slithered off somewhere, but it could always slither back and take a bite out of him. He was careful to keep both feet on the rungs of his stool and did not pay much attention to the talk of ransoms and seaports. He would go where the boys went. He was happy to let them decide. "Ma'am, we'll be pleased to take you to Galveston," Call said, "if we can find the way. It's a far piece, though, and we've got no mounts and no gear. Our horses got stolen, and the Mexicans took our guns."
"Fortunately, we aren't poor yet, we Carries," Lady Carrie said. "I didn't expect you to walk across Texas barefoot in leg irons. We have our own mounts, and we'll soon find some for you. You look like honest men. I'll send you to town with enough gold to equip us properly. Don't skimp, either. Buy yourselves reliable weapons and warm clothes and trustworthy mounts. We have a tent large enough for ourselves and Miss Roberts, but I'm afraid you men will have to sleep out, if that's not too inconvenient."
"We don't know how to sleep no way but out," Gus said. "If we can get some slickers and some blankets, we'll be cozy, I guess."
Just then the snake emerged and began to glide up one of the bedposts. Soon it disappeared back onto the canopy over the big bed. Wesley Buttons cautiously put his feet back on the ground.
"I expect it's a little too late to send you to town today," Lady Carrie said. "Emerald, tell Manuel to get the irons off these men. I want them to get into town early tomorrow. I want to leave San Lazaro quickly. These greedy Mexicans might change their minds."
"Come," Emerald said. "We fixed a room for you. The mattresses are just corn shuck, but it will be more comfortable than the place the Mexicans put you."
When they left the room, Willie had seated himself next to his mother and was helping her select from a bunch of storybooks piled beside the low settee where Lady Carrie sat. She raised her head to them as they left the room, but all they could see were her veils.
"I wonder how bad she is with the leprosy," Gus asked as the Texans were following Emerald along the balcony to their quarters. "Wouldn't it be awful if she didn't have no nose?"
"Yes, it would be awful, but I like her anyway," Call said. "She's going to get us out of here. I never supposed we'd be this lucky."
Gus thought of the long miles they had to travel over the dry, windy country to get even as far back as the settlements around Austin. It was a long way, even to the mountains where Josh Korn and Zeke Moody had been killed, and if they got that far, they would be in the land of Buffalo Hump.
"We don't know yet if we're lucky," he said. "We got to go right across where that Comanche is."
"It still beats being a prisoner and wearing these damn chains," Call said.
Part 4.
Buffalo Hump caught Kirker, the scalp hunter, in a rocky gully just east of the Rio Pecos. Kirker had 40 scalps with him at the time. Buffalo Hump judged the scalps to be mostly Mexican scalps, but he tortured Kirker to death anyway. The man had not been easy to take. He had managed to get in amid some rocks and delayed them a whole day, an annoying thing to the war chief. The Comanche moon was full. He wanted to follow the old trail down into Mexico and bring back captives, children they could use as slaves or sell to the half-breed traders in the trading place called the Sorrows, near the dripping springs where travelers on the Llano stopped to rest and water their animals. Buffalo Hump did not like having to slow his raid to catch one scalp hunter, a man so weak that he only killed Mexicans and rarely even attempted to take an Apache scalp or a Comanche. At first he considered leaving three men to hide and wait. When Kirker thought he was safe and came out of his hiding place in the rocks, the men could kill him and then follow the raiding party south. Kicking Wolf, though, protested so vigorously that Buffalo Hump gave in. Kirker had killed two of Kicking Wolf's wives and one of his sons. He had taken their scalps and sold them. Kicking Wolf was not a man who forgave or forgot. He wanted to take part in Kirker's death. The Comanche moon had only just turned full. They could easily sweep on into Mexico and take their captives. Kicking Wolf even had an idea that would help drive Kirker out of his hole in the rocks, and he put it into practice at night just before moonrise. He had his young warriors catch several snakes and tie their tails together so tightly that they couldn't rattle well. Of course, the rattlers' heads had to be held down with a stick. They grew angry at the mistreatment they received. There were 7 snakes in all. Once the 7 were bound together by the tails, a young brave named Fast Boy climbed up on the rocks above Kirker and threw the bundle of snakes down on top of him. Kirker screamed when the first snake bit him. When he screamed, revealing his position, Buffalo Hump himself jumped down on him and knocked his gun away before he could kill himself. Fortunately, the snake had only bitten Kirker in the leg. The wound would not kill him or weaken him enough to spoil the torture. Even before they got Kirker back to camp, Kicking Wolf, who could not be restrained when he was angry, poked a sharp stick in Kirker's ear, destroying his eardrum and causing much blood to run out of his head. Kirker snarled and howled like a tied wolf. He spat at the Comanche so many times that Buffalo Hump took a needle and thread and sewed his lips together. After that he could not scream loudly, though he rolled and writhed and made gurgling sounds as he was being burnt and cut by Kicking Wolf, who insisted on doing most of the torturing himself. Some of the braves were in favor of saving Kirker. They wanted to send him back to the main camp so the squaws could torture him. One squaw, named Three Seed, was better at torture than any man. She could bite off a man's fingers or toes as neatly as if she were merely biting a willow twig. Buffalo Hump, though, was impatient. It was true that Kirker was a bad man who deserved to be tortured by the squaws, but the squaws were 4 days' ride to the north, and the raiders' business lay to the south. Kicking Wolf might not be as expert at torture as Three Seed, but he was good enough to make Kirker writhe and gurgle through a whole afternoon. He had been burned and cut and blinded when they took him to a small tree near the Pecos and tied him upside down. They built a small fire beneath his dangling head and prepared to ride off. The greasewood would burn all night. Long before the sun rose, Kirker's head would be cooked. Even so, when Buffalo Hump mounted and indicated that it was time to take advantage of the Comanche moon and get on with the serious business of the raid, Kicking Wolf refused to leave. He was determined to enjoy Kirker's torture to the end. He jabbed a thorny stick into Kirker's other ear and let the blood from his head drip into the fire. Buffalo Hump was irritated, but Kicking Wolf, as a warrior, could do as he pleased up to a point. The man knew the way to Mexico as well as anyone. It was not likely that Kirker would last until the morning. Kicking Wolf would follow and catch up the next day. Still, before he left, Buffalo Hump made sure Kicking Wolf knew he was expected in Mexico soon. Kicking Wolf was the best horse thief in the tribe and also the best stealer of children. He moved without making any sound at all. Once or twice he had reached through a window and taken a child while its parents were right in the room, eating or quarreling. Buffalo Hump did not want Kicking Wolf lingering too long, just to torture one scalp hunter. The man was already too weak to respond strongly to torture anyway. He only jerked a little and made a weak sound behind his sewn lips when the flames touched his head. Kicking Wolf paid little attention to Buffalo Hump and the other warriors as they rode off to the south. He was glad the war chief was gone. Buffalo Hump was a great fighter, but he was too impatient for the slow business of torture.
For the same reason, Buffalo Hump was not an especially good hunter. He often jumped too soon. Torture took patience, and Buffalo Hump didn't have it. Before the warriors were even out of sight, Kicking Wolf took a stick or two off the fire and touched them to Kirker here and there, causing the man to jerk like a speared fish. The jerking made Kicking Wolf happy. It was good to be rid of the impatient war chief, good to be alone to hurt the man who had scalped his wives and his little son. In a little while he cut the bloody threads that Buffalo Hump had used to sew Kirker's lips together. Then he stoked the fire a little and grabbed Kirker by the hair so he could hold the man's face right over the flames. He wanted to hear the man scream. After the first screams were over, Kicking Wolf scattered the fire a little and let Kirker's head hang down again. He got up and walked a short distance to a pile of rocks, carrying one of the burning sticks to give him a little light. He wanted to find some little scorpions and put them on the white man. The scorpions would hurt him, but would not kill him, and the torture could go on. Carl was surprised by Lady Carrie's riding. She rode side-saddle, of course, but handled her black gelding as expertly as any man. She could even make the horse jump, putting him over little gullies and small bushes while at a gallop. Carl thought that was foolish, but he had to admit it was skillful and pretty to watch. Willie tried to get his pony to jump like his mother's gelding, but of course the pony wouldn't. Mrs. Chubb rode a donkey and protested constantly about its behavior, though Gus pointed out to her that her donkey behaved no worse than most donkeys.
"In England they behave better, sir," Mrs. Chubb insisted. "This one tried to bite my toe."
Emerald, the tall negress, rode a large white mule. She astonished Gus when she told him that the mule had sailed over from Ireland, along with Billy's pony and Lady Carrie's black gelding. "I doubt I could get fine enough of a mule to bring one on a ship," Gus said. He himself was riding a lively bay, procured in El Paso. In fact, thanks to Lady Carrie's largesse, they were all better mounted than they had been at any time during their journeying. Each man had two horses, and they were four pack mules. One carried Lady Carrie's canvas tent, the others carried provisions, including plenty of ammunition. They all had first-rate weapons, too, brand-new rifles and pistols, and a pretty shotgun for shooting fowl. Gus was eager to try the shotgun on prairie chickens. He had acquired a taste for the birds. But traveling east out of El Paso, they saw no prairie chickens, only desert. Gus did manage to bring down a lean jackrabbit with a shotgun, but upon inspecting the rabbit, Emerald declined to cook it. "Lady Carrie doesn't care for hares unless they're jugged," she said. Lady Carrie had raced far ahead. She was still completely veiled, so veiled that Carl didn't know how she could see prairie dog holes and other dangers of the trail. But she rode fast, her veils flying, and the black gelding rarely stumbled. At four, to the ranger's astonishment, the party stopped so that tea could be served. A small table was set up, covered with a white damask cloth. A fire was made. While Emerald sliced a small ham and made little sandwiches, Mrs. Chubb brewed the tea. The sugar bowl was brought out, and sugar tonged into the cups. All the rangers liked the tea and drank several cups. They decided they approved of English customs. Carl, though he enjoyed the tea, thought it was foolish to waste an hour of daylight sitting around a table in the desert. The boys could drink all the tea they wanted at night. Why waste the daylight? But he had to admit that otherwise Lady Carrie's arrangements had been excellent. The saddles were the best that could be located in El Paso. Also, mindful that winter was approaching, Lady Carrie had insisted that they buy slickers, warm coats, and plenty of blankets. If Caleb Cobb's expedition had been half so well equipped, it might have succeeded, at least in Call's view. With proper equipment, it would have had a chance. At night, with Long Bill's help and Gus's, Emerald set up Lady Carrie's tent. While the tent was being anchored, Lady Carrie sat by the campfire and read Willie's stories from one of the storybooks they had with them. Some of the rangers, unused to having a lady handy who would read, listened to the stories and enjoyed them as much as Willie. Matilda Roberts, for her part, enjoyed them more than Willie. The young Viscount, after all, had had the stories read to him many times. But Matilda had never heard of Little Red Riding Hood or Jack and the Beanstalk. She sat entranced, letting her tea get cold as Lady Carrie read. Even more entrancing than the stories was Lady Carrie's singing. Mostly she sang light tunes, Annie Laurie, Barbara Allen, and the like. The light tunes suited the men best, but now and then, as if bored with the sentimental tunes,
Lady Carrie would suddenly let her voice grow and grow until it seemed to fill the vastness of the desert. She sang in a tongue none of them knew, none, that is, except Quartermaster Brognoli, who suddenly stood up and attempted to sing with her. He had not emitted an intelligible sound in so long that his voice was hoarse and raspy, but he was trying to sing, and there was life in his eyes again. A vein stood out on his forehead as he attempted to sing with Lady Carrie.
"Why, he's Italian, and he knows his operas," Lady Carrie said. "Now that he's found his voice again, I expect he'll be singing arias in a day or two."
That prediction proved wrong, for Quartermaster Brognoli died that night. Call looked at him in the morning and saw at once that he was dead. His head was twisted far around on his back and neck. "I guess that jerkin finally killed him," Gus said when the sad news was reported.
"No, it was the opera," Lady Carrie said. "Or perhaps it was just hearing his native tongue."
Quartermaster Brognoli was buried in the hard ground. The four remaining rangers took turns digging. Lady Carrie sang the same piece she had sung when the Mexican firing squad cut down Bigfoot and the others. All the men cried, although Wesley Buttons had never been fond of Brognoli. Still, they had traveled a long way together, and now the man was dead. In the vastness of the desert, each reduction of the group made them realize how small they were, how puny in relation to the space they were traveling through. "We're back where it's wild again," Call said. Lady Carrie happened to overhear the remark. She drew rein for a moment, looking toward a faint outline of mountains in the east.
"Yes, it's wild, isn't it?" she said. "It's like a smell. I smelled it in Africa, and now I smell it here."
"It means we have to be careful," Call said.
Lady Carrie looked again at the distant mountains. "Quite the contrary, Corporal Call," she said. "It means we have to be wild, like the wild men."
She turned her head toward him and sat watching him for a moment. Call couldn't see her eyes through the several dark veils, but he knew she was watching him. One of her shirt sleeves had ridden up a bit. He could see just a bit of her wrist between the shirt sleeve and her black gloves. He and Gus had speculated a little about how affected Lady Carrie was by the leprosy. She had no trouble handling her horse, and she was dexterous with her hands when it came to pouring tea or buttering muffins. The wrist he saw was a creamy white, much whiter than Matilda's. Mattie was brown from the sun. Although she had been always polite, Call felt nervous, knowing that her hidden eyes were fixed on him.
"Are you wild enough, Corporal Call?" Lady Carrie asked. "I have a feeling you are."
"I guess we'll see," Call said. The Comanches struck deep into Mexico under the bright moon. In Chihuahua, Buffalo Hump struck a ranch, killed the rancher and his wife and all the vaqueros, and took 3 children and 70 horses. He ordered 3 young braves, led by Fast Boy, back up the war trail with the horses. He wanted the horses safely back in the main camp, in the Palo Duro Canyon, before the worst of the winter ice storms came. They could eat the horses if buffalo proved scarce. Then, with the shivering, terrified children tied on one horse, he struck east, taking only those children that were old enough to be useful slaves. The others he killed, along with their parents. At one hacienda, he tied the whole family, threw them on their own haystack, and burned them. The Comanches rode on, striking hard and fast. Once they saw a little militia in the distance, perhaps 20 men. The young braves wanted to attack, but Buffalo Hump wouldn't let them. He told them they could come back and fight Mexican soldiers any time. Now they were on a raid and needed to concern themselves with captives and horses. They soon had 10 children, 4 boys and 6 girls, none of them older than 8 or 9 years. They also had 20 more horses, which they drove with them as they turned north. Buffalo Hump was satisfied. They had taken almost 100 horses and 10 children who were strong enough not to die on the hard journey. Kicking Wolf had failed to appear. Some of the braves speculated that he had caught another white to torture. More than 30 Mexicans had been killed on the raid. Now the wind was growing colder. Buffalo Hump wanted to go to the trading place, the Sorrows, to trade his captives for tobacco and blankets and ammunition. He himself had the fine gun the Texans had given him, but he didn't use it to kill Mexicans. The fine gun he kept for buffalo hunting. The Mexicans he merely struck with his lance or put an arrow through. He wanted guns, though, not for himself, but for his braves.
There were more Texans than ever, moving west on the creeks and rivers, cutting trees and making little farms. They were easy to kill, the Texans, but there were many of them, and most of his warriors still only had bows and arrows. All the Texans had guns. Some of them could shoot well. It would be better if his young men learned to use the gun. Otherwise, the Texans might come all the way into the Comancheria and start killing the buffalo. A day south of the Rio Grande, Buffalo took a girl, a pretty Mexican girl who was caught while washing clothes on a rock in a little creek. There was a village not too far distant, but Buffalo Hump was on the girl so quickly that she did not have time to scream. He drew his knife to kill her, but in the brief struggle her young breasts spilled out of her tunic, and he decided to keep her. He had had Mexican women before, but none so appealing as the slim girl he had just caught. He gagged her with a piece of rawhide and put her over his horse. Later, when they were many miles north and not far from the river, one of the braves came and informed him that a foolish young warrior named Crow was missing. Buffalo Hump didn't wait. Probably Crow had gone to the outskirts of the village and attempted to steal a girl for himself. Crow had always been jealous of Buffalo Hump. Though only 16, he wanted everything the war chief had. The young braves became restive. They didn't want to leave Crow. He was known to be foolish. An old witch woman had told Crow that he would not die, and Crow believed her. Yet he was brave in battle, and the young warriors didn't want to leave him. Buffalo Hump finally sent two of them to find their friend. They arrived back late at night with long faces and bad news. Crow had attacked the Mexican village single-handedly, convinced that he could scare away all the cowardly Mexicans and take what he wanted from the town. The braves who went back caught a boy and made him tell them what had happened, for they had not met Crow along the trail. The boy said Crow had ridden around the village, drinking and shooting off an old gun he had found. He did scare the Mexicans away for a while, but enjoyed frightening the village people so much that he grew careless. A vaquero roped him from a rooftop. While he was spinning in the air, the village men came back and hacked him to death with their machetes. Buffalo Hump took the Mexican girl, though she struggled violently. He decided to take her for a wife. It might be that when they got to the trading place, one of the traders would offer him a very high price for the girl. Unless it was very high, he resolved to keep her, although he would have to be careful when he took her back to the tribe. His old wives were jealous and would beat the girl severely with firewood or sticks, unless he made it clear to them that they would suffer from his hand if the girl was too much damaged. Crow's loss he did not lament. It was true that Crow had been brave, but he was not respectful. Several times already Buffalo Hump had been tempted to put a lance through him in response to an insolent look. The girl, Rosa, whimpered from cold and fright. Buffalo Hump went to her and took her again. Then he stuffed the rawhide gag back in her mouth. He didn't like the sounds frightened women made. The next day, one warrior short, the Comanches crossed the Rio Grande. That day they caught two whites, an old man and an old woman, traveling west in a little wagon. They were people of God. They prayed loudly to their Jesus, but Buffalo Hump burned them anyway, in their own wagon. They screamed more loudly than they prayed. As the Comanches were riding off, a cougar jumped out of a little spur of rocks and raced away. Several of the braves gave chase. It would be a great thing if one of them could kill a cougar, but Buffalo Hump let them go. He had once longed to kill a cougar or a bear himself, and finally had killed a bear near the headwaters of the Cimarron. But it had only been an old she-bear with a wounded paw. He could not claim much credit for having killed it. Once he had put his lance in a male grizzly, but the grizzly had treated the lance like a burr and had chased Buffalo Hump for a mile. If he had not been on his best horse that day, the bear would have killed him. Of course the young braves did not manage to catch the cougar. Their horses were a little tired from the swift raid. The cougar outran them easily. Later that day, Kicking Wolf appeared. Buffalo Hump was angry with him for missing the raid, but they had taken so many horses and so many captives that he didn't bother complaining. Kicking Wolf was a very contrary man. He did as he pleased. He told Buffalo Hump he had decided to wait for them on the trail because he was enjoying the feeling he had after torturing Kirker to death. It was a feeling of great power and calm, Kicking Wolf said. He didn't want to lose it just to catch a few Mexican children and run off a few horses. He explained that he had tortured Kirker for another day after they hung him over the fire. After Kirker died, Kicking Wolf cut off all of his fingers. He meant to take them to the main camp and make them into a necklace. The fingers of the scalp hunter should not be wasted. When Kicking Wolf saw Rosa, the Mexican girl, he became immediately jealous.
He began to wish he had taken time to go on part of the raid. His only wife was old and smelly. Buffalo Hump had three young wives already, too many in Kicking Wolf's view. He was a lustful man, and could only watch enviously when Buffalo Hump went to the girl and took her. He ought to have gone to Mexico and taken a girl himself. It was only that he had been patiently torturing Kirker and didn't want to lose the feeling of great peace that came to him when the scalp hunter died.
"It's a jerky way to travel, if you ask me," Carl said. "It's still a long way to Galveston, and we ain't near through the Comanche country yet. Why is she stopping just to paint a hill?"
"You can't rush a lady like her, Woodrow," Gus said.
He, too, thought it was eccentric of Lady Carrie to stop the trip for a whole day just so she could paint the colors of a desert sunset as they appeared on the line of bluffs to the north. They had happened to be traveling below a kind of rim rock the day before and had camped just at sunset. Lady Carrie had not been able to get her easel and her paintbrushes out in time to capture the colors of rose and gold that the sun threw on the cliffs.
"Why, there's nothing like it in the world," she said. "I must paint. Willie, you might try, too. We'll wait until tomorrow and both have a go at it." "That's a good plan. I'm tired of my pony," Willie said.
Gus had managed to shoot an antelope that afternoon. He was immensely proud of himself. Emerald, the negress, walked out and butchered the animal very precisely and in half the time it would have taken Gus. Before they could even set Lady Carrie's tent up properly, Emerald returned with the best cuts of antelope. That night she cooked what she referred to as the saddle, with some corn and a few chilies they had brought from El Paso. Gus thought it was the best meal he had ever eaten. Carl had to admit it was mighty tasty. Emerald had struck up a friendship with Matilda Roberts. She showed Matilda some of the finer points of cooking game. Lady Carrie had a little chest containing nothing but salts and peppers, spices and herbs. While Emerald cooked, Lady Carrie sang, plucking her mandolin. That evening, the great boa, Elphinstone, was let out of its basket. It curled around Lady Carrie's shoulders as she sang. Carl thought Lady Carrie fearless to the point of folly. She ordered no guard, but he and Gus and Long Bill stood one anyway, taking turns through the chilly nights. Wesley Buttons was exempt from guard duty. It was well known that he could not stay awake even 10 minutes unless someone was talking to him, and Wesley's conversation was so dull that no one wanted to attempt to talk to him through the night. He was put in charge of the saddling and packing instead. Carl and Gus usually helped him take down Lady Carrie's tent. During the day of rest, while they waited for the sunset colors to come, Lady Carrie amused herself by sketching the rangers. She drew quickly and made such good likenesses of the men that it startled all of them. None of them felt that his own sketch was quite accurate, but contended that Lady Carrie had captured the other men perfectly. Toward evening, as the sun sank, the cliffs to the north reddened. Lady Carrie prepared her colors and began to paint. Willie, the young Viscount, had a small easel. His attempts at capturing the sunset were done in watercolor. Matilda stood beside Lady Carrie, watching. Seeing the red cliffs form on the canvas fascinated her, much as the stories had. She had never known anyone who could do such things. Lady Carrie painted until nightfall. But Willie tired of art and walked off with Gus in search of game. He had a small fowling piece and would pop away at anything that moved. This evening, though, nothing moved. Willie wanted to keep looking, but as the shadows lengthened, Gus grew apprehensive and insisted they return to camp. They had seen nothing to provoke unease, but Gus knew how quickly that could change in such a wild place. "There could be an Indian not 50 feet from us," he told Willie.
"But if there's an Indian, I want to see him," Willie said. "Why can't you find him and show him to me?"
"If I found an Indian, I wouldn't have to show him to you," Gus told him. "He'd be shooting arrows at us quicker than you can think. If I didn't kill the Indian, he'd kill us."
"Of course, you would kill him, I'm sure," Willie said, moving a little closer to Gus as they walked toward camp. Carl was prepared for an early start and was up before sunrise, but to his surprise, Lady Carrie had risen ahead of him. She was standing beside her easel, waiting for the first light from the east.
"I know you're restless, Corporal Carl," she said. "I painted the sunset. Now I want to paint the dawn. Go and ask Emerald to cook the bacon."
It was almost midday before Lady Carrie was content to pack up her easel and her oils and mount the black gelding. For 3 days more they moved eastward, past the line of the rim rock, but not beyond the desert or the mountains. On the afternoon of the third day, Call, Gus, and Long Bill all began to feel uneasy. There was no reason for their unease, yet they had it. Call debated scouting ahead to see if he could detect any sign of Indians. In the end, he decided against it. There were only the four of them to fight in case of attack, and Wesley Buttons was a notably unreliable shot at that. It was probably better to stay together in case of trouble. Toward evening, they passed a solitary mountain, a lump of rock, mainly. Lady Carrie rode off toward the mountain to have a closer look. Despite many warnings about the Indians, she still darted off at will, now ahead and now behind. She took a keen interest in the desert plants, and would sometimes dismount with her sketch pad and draw a cactus or a sagebrush. Once or twice she had galloped so far away that Call had ridden out protectively to be in a position to help if he needed to help. Lady Carrie, though, made it clear that she did not welcome even the best-intentioned supervision. "I'm not a chicken, Corporal Call," she said to him once. "You needn't act like a hen." Gus felt a deep disquiet, not about Lady Carrie, but about the place. Looking at the high, rocky hump, he suddenly realized that he had looked at it before. Only before, he had been racing toward it from the east in the hope of killing mountain sheep. Now they were coming toward it from the west. The sloping ridge the Comanches had hidden themselves behind was just ahead of them. Call had the same recognition at the same time. They had gone east from El Paso and come back to the bluff where Josh Korn and Zeke Moody had been killed. "I hope there ain't no mountain sheep up there," Gus said. "If there are, we'll know they're Comanches and that big one is somewhere around." "Maybe he's still north," Call said, remembering the day when the Comanches had walked their horses along the face of the Paladuro Canyon. "No, he ain't north. I feel him," Gus said. "Now that's mush," Call said. "You didn't feel him the first time, and he was closer to us than I am to Willie." "I didn't say he's close, but he's somewhere around," Gus said. "I feel funny in my stomach." "At least Major Chevalier would be proud of us if he could see us now," Call said. "Why would he?" Gus asked. "He never even made us corporals." "No, but now we've found a road to El Paso," Call said. "It's south of them high bluffs. If he was alive, he could start up a stagecoach line." Gus was still thinking about Buffalo Hump, how quickly he could strike. Lady Carrie was almost out of sight at the base of the mountain. If Buffalo Hump was close, even the fast gelding wouldn't save her. "Look at her," Gus said to Call. "If he was here, he'd get her." "Not just her," Call said. "He'd get us all if he was here." When Buffalo Hump rode into the trading place, the valley called the Sorrows, with his captives and the last group of Mexican horses, the old slaver Joe Nibbs was there waiting, with Sam Douglas and two wagons full of goods. A band of Kiowa had been there the day before, but they had only raided one settlement. The only captives they had to offer were a 9-year-old girl and a little Negro boy. Joe Nibbs wouldn't take the girl. She had a sickly look. Very likely she would be dead within the month. Joe Nibbs had come west with the first trappers to leave St. Louis. He was too experienced a slaver to be wasting trade goods on a sickly girl. Joe had been coming to the Sorrows for 10 years. He'd seen mothers kill themselves because he sold their children away. More than one husband had tried to kill him because he had sold a wife. But Joe was a decisive man. He kept a hammer stuck in his belt and used it to dispatch troublesome captives quickly, silently, and cheaply. He knew where the human skull was weakest. He rarely had to strike twice when he pulled his hammer. Bullets he normally saved for buffalo or other game too big and too swift to be dispatched with a hammer. When the Kiowa arrived with one sickly girl, Joe Nibbs upbraided them for laziness. The Texas settlements were creeping westward up the Brazos and the Trinity. If the Kiowa didn't want to make the long ride into Mexico for captives, they could at least be a little more active around the new settlements. Most of them weren't really settlements anyway, just groups of scattered farms always poorly defended. They ought to yield more than a sick girl and a small Negro boy. In the wagons were blankets and beads, knives, mirrors, a few guns, and some harmless potions and powders that Joe passed off as medicine. He did not trade liquor. Life was risky enough on the Comancheria without pouring liquor into wild men skilled at every form of killing. He traveled in the Indian lands with Sam Douglas, a youth of 22, reedy but strong. He kept the wagons repaired and the captives secured. Sam had come from a whaling family back in Massachusetts. He was so skilled with knots that in the 3 years he'd been helping Joe Nibbs, not a single captive, male or female, had escaped. Sometimes, if the Comanche seemed restive, Sam would entertain them by tying intricate knots. Kicking Wolf was particularly fascinated by this skill. He would sit by Sam and encourage him to run through his whole repertory of knots. Then he would want Sam to untie all his knots and tie them again, over and over. Sam Douglas had grown up by the sea. He was used to cool, moist air. He had hated the West with its sand and its dust and had no fondness at all for Joe Nibbs, a greedy, profane, violent old man with black teeth and a blacker heart. More than 20 times Sam had seen Joe Nibbs fly into a rage, yank out his hammer, and crack the skull of some man or woman who could perfectly well have been sold for a fine profit if only Joe had been able to hold his temper. But Sam stayed with the old slaver because he was handicapped by a clubfoot and a hare lip, both impediments to the satisfying of his considerable lust. In the settlements, women shied from him, but traveling with a slaver solved that problem. There were always budding girls amid the captives, and sometimes grown women, too. Since it was Sam's job to tie the women and to guard them, he had access to many females he could not have approached or succeeded with had he met them in Massachusetts. Many of them writhed and squirmed, or begged and wept, or cursed and spat while Sam was enjoying his access, but he paid no attention. They were slaves, and he was their slaver. They had to submit, and most did, without him having to whack them or whip them or tie their legs to opposite sides of the wagon bed. Even if he had to beat the women a little, he was still kinder to them than Joe Nibbs. Joe was apt to whip them for no reason, or torment them with the handle of his hammer, or tie them over a wagon wheel and rut at them from behind like the rough old Billy that he was. The moment Buffalo Hump and Kicking Wolf rode into the Sorrows with their bunch of Mexican children, Sam noticed the girl Rosa. Joe Nibbs noticed her, too. She had a beauty not often seen in captives.
"Why, he's caught a pretty one," Joe Nibbs said. "Him lazy Kiowas could ride for a year and not catch a girl that rare."
"Let's buy her, Joe," Sam Douglas said. "Maybe the Apaches would buy her. They'd give us silver for her. They take lots of silver off them Mexicans they kill." What Sam was really thinking was that they would get to keep the girl for a while. Old Joe could go first and rut at her from the back if he wanted to. Then it would be Sam's turn, and he might take it 2 or 3 times a night under the pretense of seeing the girl was properly bound.
"Shh! Hush about the Apaches," Joe instructed. "Buffalo Hump hates everybody but his own tribe, and he don't like too many of them. We don't need to let on what we aim to do with his gal."
They watched closely as the Comanche raiders rode down into the shallow valley, just a cleft between 2 ridges, really. In the distance, they could see a curve of the Rio Rojo. The wind was blowing hard from the north. Spumes of sand curled over the lip of the ridge to the north and blew into the eyes of the Mexican captives. The Mexican children appeared to be well-fed, Sam noted. Some of them were as plump as the little Negro boy who was tied in the first wagon. Several of the Mexican girls looked to be 8 or 9 years old. They could be used if there was no one better, but Sam Douglas didn't figure on having to drop that low. Not if the wily Joe Nibbs could talk Buffalo Hump out of the young woman. Joe had bought captives from most of the major chiefs north of the Santa Fe Trail and south. He knew a route through the Carlsbad Mountains that allowed him to slip back and forth between Comanche and Apache, desert and plain. He was the oldest slaver on the plains, good at figuring out what a given Indian would take for a prize captive. The girl who rode behind Buffalo Hump, her wrist tied with a rawhide thong, was the prettiest woman to come up the Comanche war trail since Sam had been driving a wagon for Joe. Joe Nibbs was rarely nervous when among the red men. He cheated white men freely, but he didn't cheat Comanches or Apaches or Kiowa or Pawnee or Sioux. A trader who cheated Indians might survive a year or even 2, but Joe Nibbs had survived almost 20 by saving his tricks for the whites. Even an Indian who didn't speak a word of the white man's tongue would know when he was being cheated. It was a practice that didn't pay. Buffalo Hump, though, was one Indian who made Joe Nibbs nervous. He dealt with the humpback because Buffalo Hump raided deepest into Mexico and brought back the most captives. But with Buffalo Hump, Joe was always careful, always aware that he was doing something not quite safe, not quite within the normal range of hazards that went with the slaving trade on the wild Texas prairies. Joe Nibbs was always aware that the day might come when Buffalo Hump would rather kill than trade.
In his dealing with the humpback, he'd only once looked the war chief in the eye. What an eye. What he saw then unnerved him so that he immediately gave the war chief a brand new rifle and several fine blankets. As soon as the Comanches had gone, he warned Sam Douglas to keep his eyes to himself when dealing with the big Comanche. No wise man met the eye of a mad dog or a wolf, a bear or a panther. The animal might come out, and blood be spilled over nothing more than a glance.
"Hell, I won't look at him at all," Sam said. "That damn hump is an ugly thing anyway."
Buffalo Hump saw immediately that the slavers wanted Rosa, the Mexican girl. He had once come upon the slavers while the old one was tormenting a dead missionary's wife. He had watched from a distance as Joe Nibbs beat the woman with the handle of his hammer, beat her and did more. That night the woman died from the beating and abuse. She had not been young. What he mainly wanted from the slaver was knives and needles. It would soon be time for the fall hunt. They needed to kill many buffalo before the winter came. Often ice storms came, coating the plain for several days at a time, making hunting difficult. The white men made good knives, far better than the stone knives his people had had to use when he was a boy. After the hunt, there would be much cutting. The women would need knives and also needles for sewing leggings from deerskin and stitching buffalo robes. The white man's blankets Buffalo Hump mostly scorned. Buffalo robes were warmer. But he liked the yellow cloth that shed the rain and allowed his braves to hunt on wet days and yet be dry like ducks. The rifles he was offered were cheap, and his young braves were rough with guns. Soon half would be broken and the ammunition used up. It was not worth giving up good captives for weapons that would be broken in a month. He himself had the fine gun the white chief Caleb Cobb had given him. He was careful with the gun. No one in the tribe was allowed to touch it. Kicking Wolf was bitterly jealous that Buffalo Hump had such a gun, but he knew better than to disobey the edict. Buffalo Hump only rarely shot the gun. He had not even taken it with him on the raid, preferring to depend on his bow and his lance. But once he had shot it at an antelope, a very great distance away, and the antelope fell. But if the old trader, Joe Nibbs, thought he could trade a few cheap weapons for the Mexican girl, he would have to think again. Buffalo Hump was willing to give him several of the Mexican children for a box full of good sharp knives, the girl he meant to keep. It might be a cold winter. A fresh young wife to lie with would be good to have on days when the ice covered the plains.
"Now don't be mentioning that girl. Don't even look at her," Joe Nibbs warned Sam Douglas. "I'll trade for the brats first, and remember what I said, don't look him in the eye."
"Why would I want to? He's a goddamn stinking Indian," Sam said. Kicking Wolf at once wanted the Negro boy. When the boy was brought out of the wagon naked and saw Buffalo Hump, he was so frightened that he tried to run away, speeding on his little legs toward the ridge the sand spumed over. The Comanche braves followed, curious. Kicking Wolf and the others had seen few blacks. They thought the boy might be some kind of small black animal. Perhaps he could be trained to gather firewood, or just to be kept as a pet like a bear cub. Just as the little black boy was about to get to the ridge, Kicking Wolf picked him up screaming and brought him back to the wagons.
"That's my brat. Give him back," Joe Nibbs said.
Kicking Wolf, too, was a man to be wary of. Everyone on the plains knew what a good thief he was. Joe and Sam had two extra donkeys with them beside the horses that pulled the wagons. He meant to see that the donkeys were close hobbled that night, else Kicking Wolf would come back and take them. Kicking Wolf motioned toward two of the captives, indicating that he would trade them for the black boy. Before Joe Nibbs could even walk over and inspect the children to be sure that they were healthy, Buffalo Hump lowered his lance and put it in front of the children. Kicking Wolf had not set foot in Mexico. Who was he to be offering the captives in trade? While they had been raiding, he had lingered near the Pecos, torturing one scalp hunter to death. Of course, Kicking Wolf had made many raids and taken many children. He would have to be allowed some booty. But he could not simply trade away children that were not his. Fast Boy had taken the two children in question. If anyone had the right to dispose of them, it should be he. Kicking Wolf was very annoyed by Buffalo Hump's intervention. He himself, not Buffalo Hump, was the great child thief. He had taken more than 50 children from their homes and brought them north. It was because of his skill as a child thief that the tribe had had plenty of knives the last few winters. Who was Buffalo Hump to deny him two children when all he wanted in exchange was a small black animal?
"Even swap. Even swap,"
Joe Nibbs said, pointing at a Mexican boy who was about the same size as the little Negro.
He didn't like trading blacks, not on the plains. He'd only given a packet of needles and a small blanket for the black boy. In the South, it was profitable to trade little blacks, but not on the plains, and even less so west of the Carlsbad Mountains. The Apaches had superstitions about blacks. They usually killed them.
Buffalo Hump allowed the trade. One Mexican child for the black cub Kicking Wolf held. He had merely lowered his lance to remind Kicking Wolf that he was not the war chief. Of course, Kicking Wolf was an unusually good raider. The need to torture Kirker had distracted him, but his pride had to be considered. He could have the black cub.
Joe Nibbs produced tobacco, and the trading went quickly. Buffalo Hump kept 4 captives, including the girl Rosa. The other 3 were Mexican boys old enough to be useful slaves. The others he traded for 3 boxes of knives, many needles, some mirrors, a box of fish hooks, and 4 rifles. Several of his younger braves considered themselves to be great marksmen. It was well enough to take a few guns for them to break.
"He don't like guns much," Sam said to Joe. "He only took 4. How are we going to get this girl if he won't take guns?"
Rosa, still tied, sat by a little bush near Buffalo Hump's horse. She had seen the 2 traders looking at her. She felt no hope. Either the white men or the Comanches would use her and kill her. She watched the sand spuming over the ridge as the wind gusted. She wished she could simply lie down and be covered with sand, be dead, be at peace. She watched the sand come and tried not to think. Joe Nibbs was wondering the same thing as Sam. What could he offer Buffalo Hump that might make him part with the girl?
"I got that old gypsy glass," he said.
Some months before, he had found a wagon and a dead man, an old gypsy, on the Kansas plain near Fort Lawrence.
Probably the old man had been killed by Pawnees, who had ripped up his body and his wagons, taken his whiskey, and left.
Joe had happened to notice something shining through a crack in the wagon bed and had discovered a ball of glass or crystal hidden so well that the Pawnees had not noticed it.
"He might want that glass," he said, going to his wagon and taking the glass from a blanket he had wrapped it in. It was the size of a small melon. When you looked into it, it made your face elongated. "It's gypsy glass. Take it to your medicine man. He can use it for prophesying," Joe said, offering the ball of glass to Buffalo Hump.
All the warriors crowded around, exclaiming at the way the glass made their faces long. Buffalo Hump thought the glass a very odd thing. He turned it over and over and let his young braves handle it. It was clearly a thing of power, but he was not convinced that it could be used for prophesying.
"Yes, it's a prophecy glass. That's what it is," Joe insisted. "Take it to your medicine man. He'll tell him where the buffalo are and when's the best time to hunt. He'll tell you when to go to war and when to stay home."
Buffalo Hump was not convinced, but as the afternoon waned, he began to want the glass. He wanted to take it home to his main camp and study it. Perhaps he would come to understand its power. His mother was old and knew much. Perhaps she would understand why the glass made faces long. He decided, though, to kill the traitors, the old one and the young one, too. He meant to take all the knives. There were several more boxes in the wagons. With so many knives, they would not need the traitors for several winters. He did not want Joe Nibbs coming into his country with such a thing as the glass. If it was a prophecy glass, then it could do much evil. Some of his people grew sick and died just from meeting with the whites. With such a glass, the old traitor might cause many deaths. The glass might be a trick to spread death among the Comanches, to get their robes and their horses and their hunting lands. The whites were always coming, up the rivers and the creeks, always north and west toward the Comancheria. Buffalo Hump thought the glass was a bad sign. He would take it to the main camp and let the old ones see it. Perhaps one of them would know what to do. Buffalo Hump left them the Mexican girl and took his braves over the ridge where the sand spumed. Then he told his braves that he had decided to kill the traitor, take back the captives, and get all the knives. Kicking Wolf wanted to go back with him and catch the white men and torture them, but Buffalo Hump wouldn't let him. Instead, he gave him the glass that might be evil and rode back alone. When he crossed the ridge of blowing sand, the old white man had already tied the girl to a wagon wheel and was abusing her. The young white man sat on the tailgate of the wagon and waited his turn. Buffalo Hump walked quietly over the soft sand. He had his lance and a knife.
Sam Douglas sat on the wagon trying to decide whether to take one of the 9-year-old Mexican girls or wait for night when old Joe would be sleeping. Then he could do what he pleased with Rosa. He had meant to leave the 9-year-olds alone, but after all, why should he? They were slaves. They were there. Old Joe was tiresome when he had a new